So picture this. A Category 5 hurricane just completely wipes out an island nation. I mean, total devastation. The storm clears, and the Prime Minister steps up to a podium, looks at all these devastated citizens, and says, "We will rebuild."
Right.
And, you know, they have the legal right to do that. They have the constitutional mandate from their voters. But then, quietly, an algorithm in a server room thousands of miles away just decides that their sovereign credit rating is too risky.
Exactly. It just flips the switch.
Yeah. A massive correspondent bank in New York cuts off their ability to process international wires, like just to limit their own compliance exposure. And just like that, the rebuilding stops. The Prime Minister spoke, but this invisible constitution overruled them.
It's a terrifying scenario.
It really is. So, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking you into a really dense, incredibly insightful white paper. It's called The Sovereignty of Credit, The Making and Unmaking of the Financial Constitution by Dr. Bichara Sakili.
It's a fascinating read.
It is. And our mission today is basically to uncover this invisible architecture of credit that silently governs your life, you know, our global economy and our planet's future. And we're going to look at how this whole system might actually be restructured. So where do we even begin with this?
Well, I think that hurricane scenario you just laid out perfectly encapsulates the fundamental premise of this paper, because it challenges, basically almost everything we are casually taught about money.
Right. The stuff you learn in high school economics.
Exactly. The traditional view is that finance is just this neutral middleman, you know, like a pipe that just shuttles resources between people who want to save money and people who want to borrow it.
A completely passive system.
Right. But this paper argues something very different. It argues that finance is actually an active form of constitutional power. Dr. Sakili introduces this concept of the great financial inversion.
The great financial inversion. Okay,
yeah.
Let's unpack that.
Yeah, so it basically means we've reached a point where financial representations like a debt contract, a bond, a credit score have become more fiercely protected and prioritized than the real-world capacities that actually create value.
Real-world capacities meaning like?
Like human labor.
Right.
Or public health. Or ecological stability.
The paper argues that the symbol of value has overpowered the actual source of value.
Okay, I want to make sure we ground this right away, because when you say finance acts as a constitutional power, I mean, I think of a constitution as a physical document, you know, sitting under glass in a museum somewhere.
Sure, like a founding charter.
Yeah. It outlines the laws, the courts, the elections. It's the agreed upon rules of society. So are we saying there is a second competing set of rules out there?
You can think of it like the underlying source code of a massive video game or an operating system.
Oh, I like that. The political constitution tells you how a government is elected. But this secondary financial constitution, it dictates what that government can actually afford to do. It dictates what gets built in your neighborhood and what economic rules you have to follow just to survive.
So it's the hidden rule book.
Yes. A government might remain legally sovereign within its own borders, but its operational capacity, its actual ability to do things, is distributed across all these global monetary and infrastructural relationships.
So if insurers decide your losses don't count,
right,
or if rating agencies in London classify your state debt as junk, your political sovereignty is just effectively paralyzed.
Exactly. The elected parliament can pass a law, but the financial architecture decides whether that law can physically manifest in the real world.
Wow. Okay. So to understand how a system could possibly wield that much authority, I feel like we have to look at what credit actually is at a mechanical level.
We do. We have to look under the hood.
Because, I mean, I was always taught that banks were basically just matchmakers.
The classic middleman myth.
Right. I take my paycheck, I put it in a savings account, the bank holds on to it. And then when my neighbor wants to buy a house, the bank takes my deposited money and just hands it to them. It's just shifting existing puzzle pieces around the board.
That matchmaking narrative is so pervasive, but it fundamentally misrepresents how modern banking actually operates. Commercial banks do not just hand over someone else's pre-existing savings. They actually engage in the literal creation of money through credit.
Wait, hold on. The literal creation of money?
Yes. When a bank approves a loan, they use double-entry bookkeeping. The moment you sign the promissory note, the bank registers your promise to pay as a new asset on their books.
Okay.
And simultaneously, they create a new liability, which is a brand new deposit in your checking account. They type that purchasing power into existence in that exact second.
Wait, really? They just type it into existence?
No.
I mean, there isn't a vault somewhere with a corresponding stack of cash that they're drawing from to give to me.
No. There is no vault full of cash waiting for you. The money did not exist before your signature. What the bank is actually doing, and this is a core theme of the paper, is manipulating time.
Manipulating time. Okay, now we're getting into sci-fi territory.
It sounds like it, but it's very real. The paper defines the elementary sequence of credit as a four-step process. First, there is an anticipated future capacity.
Meaning like what?
Like someone believes a business will generate revenue next year. Or a person is going to earn steady wages. It's a belief about the future.
Got it.
Second comes institutional recognition. The bank's models look at you and agree that this imagined future is credible.
So they stamp it with approval.
Exactly. Third, that recognition is converted into present purchasing power, that newly created deposit we just talked about, that allows you to buy the house or build the factory today.
Okay, so that's the time travel part. You're pulling tomorrow's money into today.
Right. But the fourth and final step is the future obligation.
The catch.
The present purchasing power legally assigns a portion of your future labor and a portion of your control back to the lender.
Okay, I really see the power dynamic here. Because if banks are conjuring purchasing power based on what they think is a credible future, I mean, they are effectively acting as gatekeepers to reality.
That's a great way to put it.
They are selecting which imagined futures actually get funded and get to exist.
Mm.
But they aren't clairvoyant. How do they actually decide whose future is worth funding?
Well, they rely on a concept the paper calls legibility. Because financial institutions cannot literally see the future, they have to rely on simplified, standardized metrics.
Like what?
They look at credit scores. They look at collateral. They look at formal, documented income histories. But this creates a massive systemic blind spot. If a human capacity isn't legible to a bank's mathematical model, it just gets starved of resources.
I'm struggling to see how something truly valuable can be completely illegible. I mean, if a person or a project is generating real value, doesn't the financial system usually find a way to track it and monetize it? Mm. What exactly is slipping through the cracks here?
Think about unpaid care work.
Okay.
There are millions of people, primarily women, who care for children and the elderly. They are producing immense societal stability and real-world value. But because that work does not produce a standardized taxable cash flow, it is completely invisible to a credit model.
Oh, wow.
Or consider ecological restoration. If a community cleans up a river, that creates massive biological and health value. But unless it's packaged into, say, a tradable carbon credit, it just doesn't fit the algorithm.
That doesn't count.
Right. Even a steady but informal income stream, like a street vendor who has made a profit every single day for 10 years, is illegible. And the real danger here is that this valuation is performative.
Performative meaning it doesn't just measure the world, it actively shapes it.
Precisely. It's the exact opposite of a thermometer.
How so?
A thermometer just tells you the temperature of the room. A financial model acts like a thermostat.
Oh, I see. It sets the temperature.
Yes. If an algorithm decides a specific neighborhood is, quote unquote, high risk, it cuts off credit to the people living there. So homeowners can't get mortgages to repair their roofs. Local grocers can't get loans to expand.
And because the credit is withheld, the neighborhood physically deteriorates.
Exactly. It actually becomes high risk. The model created the very reality it claimed to merely observe.
That is wild. And that makes the standard 30-year mortgage look a lot more intimidating, if you think about it.
Oh, absolutely.
Because if you need a house but you don't have the cash, the mortgage reaches into the future, takes 30 years of your future labor, and pulls it into the present.
Right.
That allows your family to have shelter today, but it also places a massive lien on your future.
Mm.
It dictates that you must maintain a certain type of job, a certain level of income, and just a specific lifestyle just to satisfy that claim. You are pledging your future to serve the present.
It allows the future to assist the present, yes. But the present also builds a cage around the future. And this immense temporal power didn't just emerge organically out of nowhere.
Right, it didn't just fall out of the sky.
No, it is a historical ledger. It was meticulously built over centuries by specific institutions to solve very specific problems. The sovereignty of credit is an assembled architecture.
Okay, so let's trace that architecture. If this is a man-made operating system, who wrote the first lines of code?
Well, we can trace a major leap forward to early merchant credit. So in the medieval and early modern periods, long-distance trade required a way for promises to travel.
Okay.
Because you couldn't just sail ships full of gold coins everywhere. It was incredibly dangerous and just inefficient. So merchants developed what they called bills of exchange.
Bills of exchange. So basically an IOU?
Yes, but a very special kind. This meant a promise to pay wasn't just a personal bond between two people who knew each other locally. The promise became a legally enforceable, tradable asset. It made the promise portable.
But wait, how did they actually enforce a piece of paper across an ocean in the 1600s? Like, if I'm a merchant in Venice and I hold a piece of paper from a merchant in London, what stops the Londoner from just ignoring it?
That is a great question. It relied entirely on merchant networks and the development of specialized commercial courts known as the Lex Mercatoria.
Lex Mercatoria. The merchant law.
Right. If a merchant defaulted on a bill of exchange, they would be blacklisted by the entire network. Their reputation was literally their liquidity.
So if you didn't honor the paper, you could no longer trade at all.
Exactly, which made the paper itself as good as money. But the architecture really scaled up when states got involved, creating what the paper calls the fiscal military credit circuit.
The fiscal military credit circuit? That sounds like funding wars.
Funding wars is exactly what it was. As European states began forming into modern empires, they realized that wars were incredibly expensive. Take King William III of England in the late 1600s. He needed to rebuild the navy to fight France, but the state didn't have the cash on hand, so the Bank of England was formed specifically to lend money to the government.
Wow. Specifically for that.
Yes. The state issued public debt. They basically borrowed present purchasing power from financiers to build ships and arm soldiers today.
And then they used those navies to expand their territory, which gave them more resources and a larger tax base.
You've got it. And a larger, more reliable tax base gave creditors the confidence to lend the state even more money for the next war.
It's a feedback loop.
A massive one. Public debt turned future tax revenues into present military capacity. The state gained unprecedented power by making its future legible to creditors.
And this wasn't just about Europe, right? I mean, how did this expand globally?
Well, as the paper details with really rigorous impartiality, this financial technology was absolutely essential to scale and colonial extraction. Finance provided the ledgers, the insurance policies, and the credit lines that made global empires function.
Yeah, the paper specifically examines the transatlantic slave trade here. And it points out that enslaved humans were explicitly coded by the financial system, not just as forced labor, but as accounting units.
That's right.
They were used as collateral for loans. And it makes the point that this wasn't just a separate moral failing happening alongside the economy.
Yeah.
The financial techniques themselves were actively organizing the extraction.
Yes. The legal architecture of property and collateral was forged in that era. And the paper makes a crucial point about how legal codes are inherited over time.
Inherited, meaning they don't just go away when the laws change.
Exactly. Consider the British abolition of slavery in the 1830s. The legal coding of value was so deeply entrenched that the British government actually paid massive financial compensation to the slave owners for their quote-unquote, lost property.
Unbelievable.
Meanwhile, the formerly enslaved individuals received their freedom, but absolutely zero financial restitution.
I want to pause on that because it perfectly illustrates this concept of inherited math. It's like moving into an incredibly old house.
Okay, I like this.
You didn't build the foundation. You might put in all this fancy smart home technology and you might paint the walls a modern color, but the plumbing, routing the water through the walls, is exactly the same as it was 100 years ago.
Yes, the infrastructure remains.
Right, so a modern banking algorithm might be completely mathematically neutral today. It just looks at existing collateral and generational wealth to decide who gets a business loan. But if that collateral was distributed unequally by those historical events, the neutral algorithm just seamlessly reproduces that inequality today.
That is a phenomenal way to look at it, the inherited plumbing.
Because the legal system perfectly preserved the wealth distribution, and that dictates who is deemed creditworthy centuries later.
Right. No one in the present day has to actively intend to discriminate. The inherited math handles it automatically, and this architecture just kept expanding and refining itself.
So how did it evolve into the modern era?
Well, in the 20th century, total war mobilization during World War II proved that governments could create vast sums of money almost out of thin air to fund armies.
Because the material existed.
Exactly. As long as the physical resources, the steel, the oil, the labor, existed to absorb that purchasing power, the money could be created. Then, after the war, the Bretton Woods system attempted to embed global finance within national social goals.
And they're trying to tame the beast.
But eventually, the rise of financialization and the absolute dominance of the U.S. dollar shifted power away from national governments and back toward highly mobile global capital.
Which brings us right to the present day and how this ancient architecture governs us right now. The paper breaks this down into what Dr. Sarli calls the financial power stack.
The financial power stack, yes.
And it's not just one big boss sitting at the top of a pyramid dictating terms, is it? It's more like a series of overlapping, intersecting powers.
Right. The stack identifies six distinct powers: monetary, allocative, valuation, disciplinary, infrastructural, and protective.
Okay, that's a lot. Let's walk through them.
Sovereignty is very fluid here. It moves around depending on the context. Let's start with monetary and allocative power.
Okay.
As we discussed with double entry bookkeeping, commercial banks hold monetary power by legally creating credit. They hold allocative power by deciding who gets that newly created money.
So deciding if it goes to a hedge fund buying up single family homes or to a cooperative building a solar farm.
Exactly. They allocate the future. Then there is valuation and disciplinary power. We touched on this with algorithms, but on a macro level, this is institutions like credit rating agencies, Moody's, Standard & Poor's. They govern credibility.
Yeah, and their power is just immense. If a rating agency downgrades a sovereign nation's debt, the interest rates that country has to pay skyrocket instantly.
Instantly.
Which can force an entire nation to enact severe austerity measures like cutting health care and education just to appease the valuation model.
It's governance by proxy. And disciplinary power is also wielded by private equity firms. They use strict debt covenants to discipline the companies they acquire, often forcing mass layoffs just to ensure that debt payments are prioritized above all else.
Now, if I'm looking at this stack as a listener, the monetary and valuation layers sort of make sense. I mean, they are the visible face of finance. But what is the most hidden layer here? What is the mechanism that affects geopolitics and everyday life the most, but we understand the least?
That would absolutely be the infrastructural layer.
The infrastructural layer. Okay, tell me about that.
These are the payment networks,
mm-hmm. The
clearinghouses, the correspondent banking channels, and systems like SWIFT. These act as the ultimate choke points of global power.
Choke points.
Yes. A developing country could have a perfectly balanced budget. They could be technically solvent and have a really healthy export market. But if they lose access to correspondent banking, if the global payment networks sever their connection, they literally cannot participate in the global economy.
Even if they have the money.
Even if they have the money. They cannot import medicine. They cannot process payments from tourists. They cannot pay for foreign software.
I want to dig into the mechanics of that.
Yeah.
Because why would a global payment network just sever a country that is doing well?
It often comes down to compliance.
Compliance.
Right. A massive global bank in New York has to comply with incredibly complex anti-money laundering laws and know your customer regulations. If they process a wire transfer for a local bank in a small country, the New York bank is heavily penalized if that money turns out to be illicit.
And the fines can be huge.
The fines can be in the billions. So to process a $50 remittance from a migrant worker, the bank has to run the exact same background checks as a $50 million corporate transfer.
Oh, I see.
The profit margins on small countries are just tiny, so the global bank just cuts them off to limit their own exposure. It's an industry practice called de-risking.
De-risking. Wow.
It's a completely rational spreadsheet decision in New York, but it financially exiles an entire nation.
And the paper expands this infrastructural power to include modern digital platforms, right? I mean, a tech platform doesn't even need to be a registered bank to wield this kind of power today.
Not at all.
If you lose your account on a major payment app or a dominant social network that you use for your business, you are functionally exiled from modern commerce. The paper calls this governance through defaults.
Governance through defaults. It's a perfect phrase.
Because most governments don't have the bargaining power to rewrite the default terms of service of global tech infrastructure. They just have to click accept, like the rest of us.
They do. And finally, rounding out the stack, there is the protective layer. This is the power to decide who gets rescued when the system inevitably crashes.
Ah, right. Like 2008.
Exactly like 2008. Central banks stepped in and provided trillions of dollars in liquidity to save commercial banks and payment networks. They possess the ultimate power to suspend the rules of the free market in order to protect the financial architecture itself.
So they protect their own. But this whole beautifully complex, mathematically precise financial power stack has a fatal flaw, which really forms the core critique of this entire paper.
It does.
The entire stack is completely detached from the physical reality it is supposed to represent.
And this is where Dr. Saley introduces a really vital concept, the life ground.
The life ground. Okay, define that for us.
The life ground is the actual physical, human, social, and ecological reality that makes life and therefore any economic activity possible.
So the real world.
The real world. It is breathable air, clean water, healthy workers, social trust, functioning hospitals. What? Without the life ground, the numbers on a screen mean absolutely nothing. As they say, you cannot eat a derivative.
You cannot eat a derivative. I love that. But the financial stack doesn't see the life ground, does it?
No, it doesn't. It suffers from a phenomenon the paper terms financial autopietization.
Okay, let's break that term down because it sounds like heavy academic jargon, but the concept is actually terrifying. Autopietization.
Right. Autopoiesis refers to a system that is capable of reproducing and maintaining itself. In this context, it means the financial system has become entirely self-referential.
Self-referential, meaning it only talks to itself.
Exactly. It only responds to its own internal codes, triggers, and metrics. Think about an automated trading system. It will react in milliseconds to a margin call, or a change in risk weights, or a fluctuating interest rate.
Right.
But that same system is operationally blind to the physical destruction of a local community, or the exhaustion of a workforce, or the collapse of a watershed. It simply cannot process external realities until those realities finally crash into the balance sheet.
And by then, it's too late.
By then, the physical damage is completely irreversible.
You know, it makes me think of the algorithms that run social media feeds.
Oh, that's an interesting comparison.
Right. Because the system is programmed with a singular metric.
Right.
Maximize user engagement. It responds instantly to clicks, likes, and watch time. But it is completely blind to the fact that it might be maximizing engagement by promoting outrage or destroying political discourse or severely damaging the mental health of teenagers.
Yes.
It is autopoietic. It only cares about its internal engagement dashboard, and it's completely disconnected from the societal life ground it is eroding.
That is a phenomenal parallel.
Yeah.
Because both systems optimize for their internal metric regardless of the external carnage. In finance, this creates what the paper calls a hierarchy of visibility and a hierarchy of the protectable.
Which means we rescue the visible things first.
Exactly. When a crisis hits, you see this hierarchy in stark relief. If bank liquidity is threatened, or a major clearinghouse might fail, central banks mobilize immense resources over a single weekend. The rescue is instant because the threat is highly visible to the financial models.
But if human communities are facing eviction,
or ecosystems are facing collapse, they are forced to wait for sluggish, agonizing political debates.
Okay, I hear that, but I have to push back a little here. Or at least play devil's advocate. Because I also see companies doing sustainability disclosures and carbon accounting all the time now.
Yeah.
Every major corporation publishes a massive environmental, social, and governance report.
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean they are aware? Doesn't that mean the system is slowly learning to actually see the life ground?
That brings us to one of the most piercing critiques in the entire paper. It introduces the concept of organized not knowing.
Organized not knowing.
Yes, they do know. A massive financial institution might publish a beautifully designed 300-page ESG report acknowledging the climate risks they face and the community harms their investments might cause.
So the data is there.
The data is there, but knowing isn't the same as acting because those sustainability metrics rarely trigger any internal financial penalties. Because they don't change the algorithms dictating executive bonuses or alter the strict capital requirements set by regulators, the knowledge never actually changes the institution's actions. The ESG report acts as a shield. The system formally organizes itself to mathematically ignore the very information it is publishing.
Ah, so it's like a hospital meticulously monitoring a patient.
Okay.
The administrators are charting the patient's financial ability to pay the bill. They're updating the spreadsheet every 10 seconds, but they are completely ignoring the heart monitor that is flatlining right next to the bed.
Wow.
The hospital has the data that the patient is dying, but the billing department's algorithm only cares about the credit card authorization.
That is a chilling but entirely accurate analogy. And on a sovereign level, this leads to what Dr. Saley calls the post-payment condition.
The post-payment condition.
This is critical for understanding national debt crises today. A developing country might successfully pay its foreign debt obligations on time every single time. So if you look at the International Monetary Fund's balance sheet, that country looks mathematically perfect. The debt is officially classified as sustainable. But to extract the cash required to make those payments, the government had to defund public hospitals, halt all road maintenance, fire thousands of teachers, and eliminate food subsidies.
The debt is mathematically sustainable, but the physical country is quite literally rotting from the inside out.
Exactly.
The legal claim survived, but the life ground was consumed to pay for it.
The balance sheet is preserved by cannibalizing the reality it sits on top of. And if this disconnect between the spreadsheet and reality is so severe, where do we see it doing the most damage right now? Where is the canary in the coal mine for all of this? The paper argues we must look at the Caribbean.
The Caribbean microcosm.
Oh.
Yeah, Dr. Sakili focuses intensely on small island developing states, and not just as some peripheral anomaly, but as a magnifying glass.
Right.
The vulnerabilities of these small nations make the hidden mechanics of global finance blindingly obvious.
Small states lay bare the violent friction between legal sovereignty and actual usable monetary capacity. The paper highlights several paradoxes here, starting with the savings paradox.
The savings paradox.
There is this assumption that Caribbean nations struggle economically because they simply have no money. But frequently, these nations actually have incredibly high domestic savings sitting in their local banks.
So the wealth is physically sitting in the vaults, right there on the island.
It is. But those local banks will rarely lend that domestic money to local businesses for productive transformation.
Why not?
Like building a domestic solar grid or funding local agriculture to replace imported food. They won't do it because local projects don't fit the rigid global standards of bankability.
Bankability, meaning they don't look right on paper.
Exactly. The projects are deemed too small or too risky, or they just don't produce the standardized collateral that financial models demand. Consequently, local banks often take those domestic savings and invest them in foreign government bonds like U.S. Treasuries, instead of investing in their own local autonomy.
That is maddening.
Mm.
But the deeper trap the paper explores is the difference between domestic money and foreign exchange.
Mm.
Because if I'm a sovereign Caribbean government, I can print my own local currency to hire local workers to pave a road. Right? I don't need international permission to do that.
You can hire the labor, yes. But you cannot pave a road with just labor. You need asphalt. You need heavy earth-moving machinery. You need engineering software. And to import those things, the global market does not want your local Caribbean currency. They demand U.S. dollars or euros.
So you're stuck.
This creates a vicious foreign exchange constraint. Your domestic policy is completely handcuffed by your desperate need to acquire foreign currency just to maintain basic infrastructure.
And even when they do manage to acquire the dollars, they slam right back into the compliance paradox, which goes back to that de-risking we discussed earlier.
Right.
You have the money, but the correspondent banking choke points refuse to process your wires because your transaction volume is just too small to justify their compliance costs. You achieve what the paper brutally calls solvency. Without usability.
Solvency without usability.
You have the money to pay for the imported asphalt, but you are physically blocked from sending it.
It is administrative exile, plain and simple. And layered on top of all these financial paradoxes is the existential threat of climate change. The paper introduces a profound reframing here with the concept of the ecological creditor.
The ecological creditor.
Yeah.
Meaning they are the ones who are actually owed a debt.
Precisely. These island nations protect vital global ecosystems, the oceans, coral reefs, biodiversity. And more tragically, they absorb the most violent climate shocks, like Category 5 hurricanes.
Which are undeniably fueled by the historical and ongoing emissions of much larger, highly industrialized nations.
Yes. From an ecological standpoint, the industrialized world is in massive compounding debt to these islands. Yet legally and financially, the global architecture treats the islands purely as debtors.
The mechanics of how a hurricane actually accelerates that debt is staggering to me. If a storm wipes out an island's infrastructure, their tax base drops instantly because all the businesses are destroyed.
Right.
Simultaneously, their imports spike because they desperately need building materials, emergency generators, and food just to keep people alive. So they have this massive fiscal gap. They have to take on highly expensive foreign debt just to survive the month. How do they ever break that cycle?
The global financial system currently offers no mechanism to break it. None. The paper maps this out as the debt disaster dependency cycle.
Debt disaster dependency.
The brutal repayment terms of the new emergency debt force the government to cut future spending. And what gets cut? long-term climate adaptation. They can no longer afford to build seawalls or transition to resilient agriculture.
Because they have to pay the banks.
Which means when the next hurricane hits 5 years later, the physical damage is exponentially worse, requiring even more debt.
The system literally guarantees its own failure. It mandates dependency. It just proves that the financial ledger demands immediate cash payment, while the ecological ledger demands repair and resilience. And the financial ledger currently holds all the constitutional power. So if the Caribbean proves that the source code is fundamentally misaligned with human survival, how does Dr. Sahuli propose we actually rewrite it?
Well, the paper's solutions do not start with tweaking interest rates. They start with a profound philosophical and legal reframing. Credit is delegated public power.
Meaning credit creation is not just a private right for banks to extract whatever profit they can find.
Exactly. Commercial banks and financial markets only exist and only function because they rest upon a massive foundation of public infrastructure.
Like what?
They rely on public courts to enforce their debt contracts. They rely on property laws to secure their collateral. And most importantly, they rely on the public purse and central banks to bail them out when they take on too much risk.
Right. The 2008 bailout.
Because they utilize this public infrastructure, they owe the public a reciprocal duty. Dr. Sahuli proposes rewriting the source code by legally enforcing a life-grounded hierarchy of claims.
We talked about how, currently, financial derivatives and bank liquidity get rescued first in a crisis, while human needs come last. What does this new hierarchy actually look like on the ground?
It legally flips the crisis rescue order. In any restructuring, bankruptcy, or national crisis, claims would be prioritized in a very specific order.
Okay, let's hear the order.
Number one, the immediate conditions of life. Food, shelter, safety, and emergency health care must be protected and funded first before a single dollar goes to debt service.
Okay, I see.
Number two, the infrastructure of collective life. So water systems, power grids, sanitation. Number three is productive capacity, the actual businesses and farms creating real goods. Number four, ordinary security, meaning people's earned wages and pensions.
And where are the banks?
Number five is rescue finance. And finally, number six, at the very bottom, are speculative and residual financial claims. They must legally absorb the losses first.
It's like rewriting the emergency landing instructions on an airplane.
How so?
Well, right now, the financial systems manual basically says, in the event of a loss of cabin pressure, secure the oxygen mask on the stock portfolio first and allow the human passengers to suffocate.
Unfortunately, yes.
But this new legal hierarchy says, no, the humans get the oxygen first. The physical infrastructure gets the oxygen second. And whatever oxygen is left over goes to the speculative assets. If the assets suffocate, so be it. The life ground survives.
That is exactly the shift in priority. And to operationalize this, the paper argues we need a plural banking ecology.
A plural banking ecology.
We cannot rely solely on commercial megabanks to allocate all credit. We need public green banks, credit unions, and cooperative institutions operating alongside them with equal weight.
Because they have different time horizons, right? I mean, a commercial bank might only be able to see a 3-year return on a luxury condo development.
Right.
But a public green bank is designed to see the 30-year return on a climate-resilient energy grid. We need institutions whose algorithms are actually capable of reading different kinds of value.
Precisely. We need different lenses. The paper also touches on something that feels incredibly urgent regarding the infrastructural power layer, digital public money as civil commons.
This is huge, especially right now.
As physical cash increasingly disappears, the paper warns that digital money must be legally enshrined as a public right. It must have strict privacy protections and offline capabilities. The paper offers a really stark warning here. The payment instruction may be programmable. The person should not become programmable.
Man, that is powerful. Because if a private tech monopoly or a central bank fully controls a programmable digital currency, they control exactly who gets to participate in society and what they're allowed to buy. Digital money has to be a civil commons. Treated like a public park or a physical highway open to everyone without algorithmic gatekeeping.
And alongside building these new structures, we have to engage in what the paper calls de-implementation.
I found this concept so fascinating. It's an acknowledgement that we can't just build new utopias on top of toxic foundations.
Right. It's not just about adding new green banks or publishing more ESG reports. We have to actively dismantle the existing rules, the tax subsidies, and the accounting metrics that currently reproduce harm.
So tearing out the old plumbing.
Yes. If a specific tax subsidy is actively encouraging fossil fuel extraction or speculative real estate hoarding at the expense of the life ground, you cannot just offset it with a carbon credit. You have to legally de-implement the rule itself.
But practically speaking, how do you enforce this globally? Does the concept of sovereign debt justice mean countries just rip up their contracts and don't have to pay their debts? Because I can hear orthodox economists screaming from here.
The paper is very careful here. It does not advocate for chaotic unilateral debt repudiation. Fidelity to promises is historically important. It's what makes large-scale cooperation possible. But it advocates for good faith restructuring based on a strict reality condition test.
How does a reality condition test work?
It means models must be subordinated to reality. If an IMF structural adjustment policy is intended to stabilize a country's debt, but the implementation of that policy repeatedly weakens the underlying society, if infant mortality spikes, if infrastructure crumbles, if human capital flees, the framework must change.
So reality gets a vote.
The economic models must be updated by the wounds of reality. Sovereign debt justice means restructuring the debt to a level where the country actually retains the physical and economic capacity to govern itself and keep its people alive.
Which brings us to the ultimate question posed by the paper, shifting our perspective from the present moment to the generations that will follow us.
Dr. Sally boils the entire complex architecture down to an ultimate choice: claim sovereignty versus life sovereignty.
Claim sovereignty versus life sovereignty.
Under claim sovereignty, the financial contract rules everything. The numbers on the ledger dictate reality, and the debt must be paid, even if reality is burning to the ground to produce the cash.
And the alternative.
Under life sovereignty, finance is put back in its proper subordinate place as a tool, a technology that serves the continuation, repair, and flourishing of life.
There is a profound statement in the paper that hit me really hard. The future cannot negotiate directly with the present.
Think about the temporal power of credit we discussed at the very beginning. Every financial claim we create today is pulling the future into the present.
Right.
But we are currently pledging the ecological and institutional future of unborn generations without their consent. We are running up an ecological and financial debt to sustain the present and leaving future generations a world completely stripped of the capacity to even repair the damage we caused.
We are literally putting a lien on their existence.
We are. And the paper closes with a powerful ethos regarding promises. Fidelity to a debt is important. Reliable promises make civilization possible. But fidelity is not captivity.
Fidelity is not captivity.
If honoring a financial contract requires the destruction of the life ground, if it destroys the very world in which that promise has meaning, the claim loses its legitimacy. The future belongs in trust to those who must live within it, not to the creditors of the past.
The paper asks, who shall inherit the future? It challenges us to realize that the open future is the true collateral of civilization.
But, you know, there is one final thought that this whole discussion brings up for me, looking at where technology is heading right now.
Oh, interesting. Where's your head at?
What happens when the financial power stack we've been talking about is completely handed over to artificial intelligence?
Oh, well, we already have automated high-frequency trading and algorithmic credit scoring. If the human-run system already suffers from organized words, not knowing, if human bankers can ignore the flatlining heart monitor, what happens when an AI, programmed strictly to maximize the extraction of financial value, holds all the valuation and disciplinary power?
That is a terrifying prospect.
The future might not just be fighting to be legible to a banker in London or New York. The future might be fighting to be legible to a machine. So the next time you hear about a national debt crisis, a major corporate buyout, or a local austerity budget, don't just ask who owes what. Ask what will be left after the debt is paid. Because usually when we look at how the world is governed, we want that X-ray. We want the power to be clean, binary, and visible. But the real power is invisible. It's in the source code of credit. And understanding how that hidden constitution works is the first necessary step toward rewriting it.